I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, psychedelics are showing therapeutic value in treating depression and anxiety, but could they also be a kind of love drug? Is there a role for MDMA, also known as Molly or ecstasy, in couples therapy?
If the drug is a facilitator or something that's enhancing a therapeutic process rather than something that you want to do all the work, then it starts to fall more on a spectrum with other kinds of things we do to work on our relationship, like going on romantic vacations and climbing mountains and meditating together, whatever else we might do. Then it becomes sort of part of that spectrum rather than something that's categorically different.
And later, the renowned Gottman Institute on the keys to a lasting and loving relationship.
What do we know about each other? How much do we like and admire one another? How do we interact in positive ways with one another? That defines a strong friendship. When couples are doing that, lots of things go well.
Love drugs and traditional therapy. How to make your relationship work. All ahead on Life Examined. In this episode, we're diving into the world of relationships, what makes them work, sustain themselves, or fall apart. And to start off, we'll circle back to a previous show we did that got a lot of attention. In it, we talked about the therapeutic uses of MDMA, also known as ecstasy, in treating a range of mental disorders, from depression to PTSD. Nicknamed a love pill, MDMA has been used in couples therapy with remarkable results. So, could love be medically prescribed? Will it someday be commonplace for couples to take MDMA together in the presence of a therapist? And how does all of this work anyway? These are the questions that bioethicist and philosopher Brian Earp has written about in his new book with co-author Julian Savulescu. It's called Love Drugs: The Chemical Future of Relationships. He's the associate director of the Yale Hastings Program in Ethics and Health Policy at the Hastings Center at Yale University and a research fellow at the University of Oxford. Brian Earp, welcome to Life Examined.
Thanks for having me on your show.
All right, so MDMA, as I mentioned, has this reputation of being a love drug. We know it produces these feelings of intimacy or euphoria with another person. So can you talk a little bit about how this drug works and how it might even make us question chemically what love is?
Sure. I think there's this emerging view that when we think about love, we have to remember that it's a multidimensional phenomenon. So, you know, we're used to talking about love in terms of what it feels like subjectively. And a lot of poetry and philosophy and literature explores the subjective dimension of love. And then there are historians who come along and point out that the social framing of love changes over time, that what, as it were, counts as love in a different historical or social context doesn't remain stable. And so they would point out that love is partly socially constructed in a certain way of thinking about things. And then this new wave of research is all about neuroscience. And it's another group of researchers saying, well, but love also has a biological dimension. Love is also something that at least in part is related to what's going on in our brains. And so if we want to have a full accounting of what love is, it's got to take into account the biology, the psychology, and the subjective experience, and the social context. So with a drug like MDMA, what's interesting is it certainly is acting on the brain. There's no doubt about that. MDMA causes the release of a large amount of serotonin, and that has a certain subjective way that it feels. And a lot of people report that it feels to them like they felt when they've experienced love in a non-drug altered state. Right. And so just in terms of the phenomenology, some people report that these things feel very similar to each other. On the other hand, there are those who say, well, if this so-called feeling of love came about because you ingested a chemical substance, then surely it's not as real as the real thing. And so what we're now seeing is a way of thinking, is there some grounding to this relationship? Does the couple have a connection that's worth restoring? They know each other. It's not just like inventing love out of whole cloth. And then could MDMA be used as a kind of aid or a supplement to an already existing authentic loving relationship just to help it improve in its quality rather than conjure it out of thin air?
Which raises a lot of interesting questions. For example, when you're on the drug and you know that all this serotonin is being released, I mean, can we call that an authentic display of love? Is that the true self, whatever that means, expressing love? Or is it just a drug kind of acting through you? What do you think?
Well, you know, lots of things affect our brain chemistry. And so just, you know, staring into the eyes of our lover and having a romantic experience with no drugs involved will also cause our brain to release a bunch of serotonin. So there's a certain sense in which neurochemically there's a lot of overlap between what happens when you experience love naturally and when you experience love with the use of a drug. I think what is more important is kind of the long-term trajectory of these things. So what some people are describing that they feel in these MDMA-assisted psychotherapy sessions, and we can just focus on the case of post-traumatic stress disorder because that's the recent research.
Yeah.
They'll say, you know, my naturally occurring brain states are themselves inauthentic. You know, I'm freaking out when I hear a loud noise, and I'm acting aggressively toward my partner. And because I'm dealing with this particular problem, you know, my non-drug mediated mental states are inauthentic. And what I'm finding is that when I'm induced to feel safe enough to talk to the therapist to actually bring up my traumas and work through them, by doing so, when the drug wears off, what I'm left with is a more integrated sense of myself. I actually feel like now I'm starting to see the world as it really is, or maybe I'm able to relate to my partner again in a more healthy way, rather than actually having the distortions that were introduced by PTSD.
Right.
And you can spell this logic out a bit. You know, our mental states fall on a spectrum between something that's obviously diagnosable as a mental disorder and just ordinary life difficulties. So, you know, you might be in a relationship with someone, say you've been with them for 10 or 15 years, and you can fall into a slump or a pattern or a set of habits that themselves might seem inauthentic, where you're actually not able to see your partner for who they really are because you've fallen into this trap, or you have this defensiveness or some sort of, you know, automatic response to them being critical, and it just always, you know, drags down into an argument. For some people, what they're finding is these MDMA-assisted psychotherapy sessions sort of wash out some of those habits and patterns that may, from their perspective, be inauthentic. And then the MDMA is really a tool to help them explore their relationship with their partner and potentially build something more authentic over the long haul.
Yeah, so much of what you said there that's interesting. And I remember once sitting in a lecture from a really well-known psychologist who talked about the fact that there are so many different things that impacts these neurochemicals or neurotransmitters like serotonin. For example, there was a study that showed you're more likely to say, I love you, to your partner after you have a really good long workout and you get your heart rate up and you're feeling right. Good, right? So There is a lot more going on than just thinking about there's life on drugs and life not on drugs, right?
Right. So there's drugs that you can ingest directly that will have a profound and immediate effect on your brain chemistry. But there's also, you know, other activities, like you mentioned, working out or going on a romantic vacation or climbing a mountain with your partner and looking out over some vast landscape and feeling inspired. All these things are going to, you know, radically affect your neurochemistry. And the point is just, what do you make of the subjective experience? Now, some people would say, rightly, I think, that if I'm with my partner and the only time I ever feel a sense of warmth or affection for them is when I've just ingested an extremely powerful substance that causes my brain to release a ton of serotonin, but I actually don't experience that when we go hiking together, then you might think, well, you don't want to be turning to a drug to do all of the work in terms of how you connect with your partner. But if you see these things as falling on a spectrum where there's different ways of interacting with your brain chemistry and the context always matters. So again, you shouldn't just be taking a drug and thinking, well, that's going to do all the work and whatever I feel, that's the end of it. It's like, what do you do with the experience on the drug? Do you talk to your partner? Do you work with a mutual therapist where you're thinking through your values and you're talking about your memories together and you're working through problems? Well, then if the drug is a facilitator or something that's enhancing a therapeutic process rather than something that you want to do all the work, then it starts to fall more on a spectrum with other kinds of things we do to work on our relationship, like going on romantic vacations and climbing mountains and meditating together, whatever else we might do. Then it becomes sort of part of that spectrum rather than something that's categorically different.
And I think what you're describing is now a more modern approach to psychedelics that didn't exist before. And you know, I'm not trying to oversimplify this, but I think there was an idea that you could just take LSD or some type of psychedelic and just by ingesting the drug alone, irregardless of the therapeutic setting, there may not even be one, that you may be transformed. Where I think the new school of thinking here is that there needs to be an actual clinical setting in the sense of maybe being with a therapist or a psychologist or a psychiatrist and working with this in a more nuanced manner than I think may have existed before. Do you think that's true?
I think there's long been an appreciation for the importance of what's called set and setting,
right.
Where set means your mindset and setting is whatever the setting is. And you're right to say that in the current wave of research, that term setting tends to refer to something like a clinical setting or a distinctively therapeutic setting with some sort of trained therapist or psychiatrist. But there are other kinds of settings that, people have employed toward therapeutic ends. You know, it might be a group meditation session, or it might be something that has to do with traditional or indigenous medicine, for example, where the setting is something that's more in a community context. So there are lots of different settings that are potentially therapeutic. You know, the psychiatric context can actually be quite threatening and unnerving for some people. Right. I was reading an account of a Black psychotherapist who herself was training to become an MDMA guide in one of these therapeutic settings. And so as part of that training, she went under an MDMA enhanced session herself. And she said, you know, being in this institutionalized setting and thinking of all the connotations of, you know, how drug use and drug monitoring and surveillance are used disproportionately to harm Black communities, she said it wasn't actually a fun place to be for me. And I might have actually been more comfortable taking this drug, you know, with other members of my community in a place right. that we know is safe for ourselves. So I think the setting affects different people differently, to be sure.
And then I think there's also this other question here, too, which is that we're already culturally taking in a lot of drugs that do change the neurotransmitters, SSRIs, for example, being, or SNRIs being the most famous. And anyone that's taken these will know that the impacts or the side effects can be profound in a really troubling way. And I think that's an important component here, that this is already happening and that there are hopes. And I know we're kind of in like the glory days of this, or the exciting phase, that certain drugs like MDMA may not carry those type of side effects.
Right. So you're right that we take a lot of drugs for medicine in this society. And a problem with how we do this currently is when we're studying the effects of those drugs, like SSRIs is a good example, the most commonly prescribed medication for depression, is that we tend only to measure the individual level symptoms that follow from that use. And so we call this drug antidepressant medication because that's what we're using it for. But what it is just a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So it does whatever it does. And if you only measure the individual effects on like my symptoms of depression, then that's all you're going to think it's going to do. Or you might measure some side effects in terms of, you know, bodily changes. SSRIs can dampen libido, for example, which has interpersonal effects. But these drugs can also directly affect the neurochemistry that underlies things like our attachment and our feelings of care toward our partner's feelings and so forth. And so right now you have a whole bunch of anecdotes suggesting that ingesting these drugs can have surprising effects on relationships, but it's not studied scientifically in a comprehensive way. Now, I don't want to suggest that SSRIs are always bad for relationships. You know, imagine that you're somebody who's seriously depressed, you can't get out of bed, you've tried all the other non-drug treatments, and you happen to be among the subset of people for whom SSRIs are an effective treatment. They allow you to get out of bed, you have a more elevated mood, you can engage with the world, and you can engage with your relationship. Well, for you, an SSRI might be like a pro-love drug. Whereas for somebody else, if you were depressed, but you were functioning in a relationship, but now you've lost your sex drive and you have no interest in having a sexual relationship with your partner, well, that could be devastating for some relationships. So the general point here is, whatever drug we're talking about, we need to be thinking not just how does it affect the individual, but how does it affect them in their relationships and in their social context.
How would you imagine this working in a couple's therapeutic context? Do you have any ideas of what that would look like or sound like?
Yeah, so to use the example of MDMA, it was used in a couple's therapeutic context prior to the 1980s mm-hmm. when MDMA was banned and was listed as a Schedule I substance. And some historians have carefully looked at that period, and it was a pretty ham-fisted and premature and scientifically unwarranted prohibition that was put forward by the Drug Enforcement Agency in the United States, and then, you know, that kind of drug policy shaped the rest of the world. But basically, it was never supposed to be listed as a Schedule I substance unless it didn't have a therapeutic use. And a bunch of psychiatrists at the time were saying, this is being primarily used therapeutically. It's just that it also seems to have been caught up in the, you know, party scene and raves and clubs and so forth. But we shouldn't conflate the misuse of a drug where people are dancing all night in warehouses and not drinking enough water right. with the controlled therapeutic use of this drug, which is what we're doing. And, you know, rather than carefully distinguishing these two types of uses, just the drug itself was banned. And now, you know, I think people are starting to realize that that was premature. But before the ban, there were a number of therapists who were using MDMA in couples counseling. And so we have a model for how this might work. And it involves bringing both partners, or potentially more than one partner, into a lab. and or a therapeutic setting of some kind, and first talking about what they want to do. You know, it's not, again, it's not just you take the drug and it fixes your relationship. It's that you have to really work with the therapist and with your partner to talk about your values, what you want to work on. And then you have maybe 4 hours on the drug, each of you independently. And then you come together and you talk through what you feel you learned on that experience as you're coming off the drug. And then you consolidate those experiences afterwards. So again, it's not that you just keep re-upping a drug every few weeks. You have a session maybe once or twice in your whole relationship. And it's just that you try to learn as much as you can from that heightened experience and then implement those lessons into your normal waking consciousness as you go forward.
How effective do you think those sessions were? Do we know much about that?
Well, in the 80s, what we have is a bunch of case studies. There are these psychiatrists who retrospectively looked at all their notes from working with about 80 different clients, and they gave a qualitative overview of what they felt the effects of the drugs were. And their view was that it was very promising as a therapeutic aid to relationships. I don't want to say treatment, because treatment implies that there's some specific pathology. And a risk here is that if you introduce a drug into relationships, the pharmaceutical companies are going to want to invent relationship disorders so they can justify why certain people need to be prescribed this drug. Mm. So I'll just say enhancement. These drugs can enhance certain relationships. There's a lot of evidence that from the 1980s, but it wasn't very controlled evidence. So what's happening now in this new wave of research is that they're starting with these individual level PTSD trials where they're finding really stunning treatment effects for people who have had treatment resistant PTSD. They've tried everything else. They've been, you know, seriously depressed and suicidal in many cases. And you're finding, you know, a rather remarkable treatment effect. And now they're just going very careful, very piecemeal. And there's some recent pilot work where they bring the partner of the person who has PTSD into the session, and they too are administered MDMA with the guidance of the therapist. And then they can work through the ways in which PTSD has been affecting their relationship, but with both of them, you know, under the influence of the drug. So they're building this out slowly and carefully now in a much more systematic, scientific, and rigorous way. And I think that will give us a better sense of what really are the conditions under which it's helpful versus what are the conditions under which maybe people shouldn't be doing MDMA-assisted psychotherapy.
I know we don't know this yet, but you're a philosopher ethicist, so this is a fair game question. I wonder, you know, what would happen in a case where you find that a couple almost becomes reliant upon the drug? Say they need to take it together every month or so, or it's kind of what can keep them together ultimately. Do you think that would be a healthy outcome of this?
Yeah, it depends on your tolerance for what you think of as artificial supplements to a relationship. I will say that MDMA causes a pretty powerful experience, and most people don't want to repeat it all that often. So MDMA, for example, is not addictive in the same way that, you know, psilocybin from magic mushrooms are neither of them are addictive. So you don't tend to become physiologically reliant on these drugs. But what you're suggesting is, you know, maybe 3 months go by and the couple feels that they've just resorted to their old patterns again.
Right.
And now they think, well, it's time for a booster shot. Let's go in and have our MDMA experience and see if that will help the relationship along. You know, I think I'm in two minds about this. I think some people would say, we really value this relationship, even though maybe we have some areas that are, you know, chronic problems for us. And, you know, if the price of being able to stay together and work on something that we really care about is getting a quote unquote booster shot kind of a thing every several months, well, then that's worth it for us. Other people might say, you know, maybe the fact that this powerful experience only gives us insights for 2 months and then we seem to have forgotten our way and we're back to bickering again. Well, maybe that will cause us to need to look more deeply into our relationship. But I will say that, you know, people think of MDMA as a pro-love drug, but in some ways it's more of a get in touch with your feelings drug. And so if you have a really toxic relationship with someone, or you're not sure that really you have shared needs or values, one, you know, documented effect of people undertaking these MDMA enhanced sessions is they come to realize that, you know, maybe we aren't really suited to each other.
Right.
And rather than, you know, throwing dishes and having a whole to do about it, maybe we can say goodbye from a place of love. Maybe we can say, you know, we've really reflected on this honestly with one another, and let's part ways and see if we can find our happiness elsewhere. So that's one possible outcome. It's not just a glue people together kind of drug.
Mm. Yeah, that's well said. And I have to point to this amazing idea of an MDMA booster shot. I can't let that one go. So thank you for bringing that into the conversation. Your book, though, does kind of touch on the other side of this as well, which is heartbreak and what it's like for people that are experiencing the loss of a relationship or a breakup or maybe even a death. Who knows? I mean, this we could even maybe move this into the grief conversation as well. But how could certain drugs impact that state of mind or situation somebody's in?
Well, there's a current dilemma that's raised by the prescription of antidepressant medication for people who are depressed for reasons that seem logical. You know, somebody might say, gosh, I'm just depressed all the time and I have no idea why, and it's not related to any feature of my life. It's just something's wrong with me and I need a drug to help me get out of this. Whereas other people are depressed because they have a horrible job or they're in a bad relationship or, you know, they're not exercising. And in those cases, I think people are right to say you should be wary of using a drug as a quote unquote crutch, because it means that it may disincentivize you from actually dealing with the deeper problems of your life and the real changes that you need to make to your circumstances. So, you know, one possibility is you get out of a relationship, you're feeling really heartbroken. And rather than just sitting with that heartbreak for a while and trying to learn from it, trying to ask yourself, well, how did I get to this place where this relationship that I thought was so great has suddenly ended? You know, is there something I can learn from this? Well, if you short circuit that process by just going to your doctor and saying, well, I'm depressed and here's all my symptoms, and the doctor writes you a script and now you take a drug which kind of dulls your emotions, I think people are right to be skeptical about that kind of a use, because it seems like you're now papering over reality when what you should be doing is reflecting on it and learning from it. On the other hand, you can imagine people who undergo some sort of radical heartbreak or maybe the loss of a partner, and they're grieving and grieving and grieving month after month or year after year, to the point where the grief isn't instrumentally helping them in any kind of a way, and it's actually preventing them from opening up to new relationships. And in some cases, you might think that if they've tried everything else, then adding a drug to the regime that could help them just break out of that cycle of despair and open up to new relationships, well, in that case, maybe people would think that that's a little bit more permissible. So you have to think about, you know, is the drug being used as a crutch or is it being used as something that facilitates growth?
Yeah.
And in the latter case, I think maybe it's all right.
I think that's huge what you just said, because I think there is a fear that we often will try to medicate our way out of any unpleasant aspect of our life. And right, we do this already. We drink lots of alcohol, we smoke weed, whatever it is. And so let's not pretend that doesn't happen anyway. It does. But this is going to be a potentially another tool. And I do some grief counseling and therapy work outside of this. And I think it's important to recognize for people that, you know, grief or loss is a regular part of life. And it's going to be a cycle to get out of it. But just as you said, once that goes on for 3 to 5 years and it puts people into, you know, a major depressive disorder, that's a different situation. I would almost equate it to almost a PTSD. They're not the same diagnosis. But at that point, I think there is more of this conversation about, you know, long-term changes to the brain versus these short-term bouts of depression or grief, right?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up PTSD, because there's some work happening right now with a psychiatrist in Canada who does something called reconsolidation therapy for people who have post-traumatic stress disorder. And what he realized was that some subset of his patients were coming in with PTSD-like symptoms, not because they were in a war or they experienced sexual assault, but because of what he calls a romantic betrayal. And so it might be that, you know, you're abandoned by your partner of 20 years and okay, you weren't in a war, but it's so shocking to your psyche that in his view, there's no reason to think of this as really any different from PTSD for some people. And so what he started to do was then to expand his treatment regime to people who were experiencing, you know, trauma from the end of a relationship. And the way it works is you take a drug called propranolol, which is a beta blocker, and it's administered in the context of his psychiatric practice. And you record a memory. You actually write out a memory that's particularly trauma-inducing for you, kind of triggering for you. And then you don't want to try to delete the memory in some sort of eternal sunshine of the spotless mind way, but you want to maybe strip it of some of its triggering capacity. And so what you do is, while this beta blocker is sort of calming your body's response, you re-record the memory and put it back into your hippocampus, but with some of that emotional valence dampened down. And then, you know, you're still able to recall what happened, but it just doesn't trigger this panic attack or whatever it was that, that maybe was plaguing you. And so that's something where, again, the drug is being used as an aid, as an adjunct to a healing process, rather than as something that short circuits the healing process.
Yeah, that's a beautiful example, and I think really illustrates some of the work that's happening. There are also, I think, ways in which this can be used negatively. I know, for example, you've thought about conversion therapy, which is something we mainly hear about in a religious context, say, trying to force somebody who identifies as gay into being heterosexual. Could this ever be used in that context?
Well, so one thing you hear about these conversion therapies nowadays is, well, not only are they harmful and unethical, but they don't work. Mm-hmm. And my colleagues and I thought, you know, we're right there with you in terms of them being unethical, certainly if they're, you know, forced on somebody. But what if they did work in the future? That kind of raises some really puzzling questions. And, you know, what if they could be administered in some way that was, you know, relatively safe from a medical perspective? Well, now you're really forced to ask yourself, what is at the heart of your ethical objections? It can't just be that it's harmful and it doesn't work. It has to be that you think there's a deeper moral problem here. And we think that's right. But in the meantime, there are religious communities, as you allude to, who have been doing something like a sort of drug-induced version of quasi-conversion therapy by using SSRIs, that same drug that we've been talking about. So there was some research of an Orthodox Jewish community in Israel where the norm is that same-sex behavior and even masturbation are religiously frowned upon. And so you have these yeshiva students who go to their counselors or their rabbis and they say, I'm struggling with, you know, same-sex feelings, or I'm struggling with a desire to masturbate. And the therapists and the rabbis will get together and say, you know, this is causing these students such distress that on some way of thinking about things, they're depressed. And so if we give them this drug, one, it can be seen as having a treatment effect. It's treating the depression. But two, we expect that it will also dampen their libido. So the so-called side effect of SSRIs is now being used in this kind of twisted logic as the intended effect. And so you find that a lot of these students kind of lose their desire for anything altogether. So they don't reorient their sexual orientation, but they do kind of become sexually dulled altogether. And, you know, this is really troubling. Now, a point to make is that relative to the norms of this group, this is might be seen as an all things considered acceptable solution to what they see as a problem. But then a wider liberal critique says, you know, it's not the same-sex feelings that are the problem, it's the restrictive norms of the group that ought to change. And so, you know, the way the drugs are used is always situated within a wider political context where you have to be asking yourself as a wider society, what are the social norms we're willing to tolerate? Mm-hmm. And how much do we want to give leeway to religious communities or other subgroups to kind of live by their own rules if that means that medicine is being used to, you know, subordinate and suppress people who are already minorities within minorities, as in the case of gay people in a minority religious community.
Well, I've been speaking with Brian Earp. Really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for your perspective today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Brian Earp is an ethicist and co-author of Love Drugs, The Chemical Future of Relationships. Still to come, why friendship is key to successful long-term relationships. Clinical director at the Gottman Institute, Don Cole, joins us after the break. And a reminder that if you missed any of our shows, check us out on Apple Podcasts. There you'll see last week's episode on the new science and lost art of breathing. This is Life Examined on KCRW. We'll be back after this short break. I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. We'll now return to our theme this week, which is relationships and how to make them last. We just heard about some new experimental work with psychedelics, in particular, how some couples might benefit from taking MDMA together in therapy. But let's be honest, not every couple is ready to do this. Instead, many rocky relationships get sorted out in traditional talk therapy. And if there is one mecca for the long-term study of marriage, it's the Gottman Institute. Back in the 1980s, psychologist John Gottman became fascinated in studying the difference between happy couples who stay together and those who don't. So, at the University of Washington in Seattle, Gottman took to observing hundreds of couples in real time. He would put them in apartments with cameras watching and listening. He would even hook up medical devices to study their physiological responses during arguments. The scientific approach was groundbreaking at the time and would inform reams of research about relationships.
Dr. Don Cole is the clinical director at the Gottman Institute and founder of the Center for Relationship Wellness. He's been counseling couples for over 40 years. And as we'll find out in just a moment, friendship and kindness are some of the strongest indicators of a successful relationship. Well, Dr. Don Cole, welcome to Life Examined.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So as I mentioned, there's been a ton of research that's come out of the Gottman Institute and a number of books as well that our listeners can check out. But I wonder, Don, can you distill down some of the major concepts that's come out of the Institute and just kind of bring us into some of those ideas and how they work?
Well, one thing I can tell you is that the science behind, you know, Gottman method therapy did not start as therapy. It actually started as science. So we didn't come up with a therapy and then create some research projects to prove the therapy. Instead, John Gottman and his colleague, Bob Levinson, and others were really just interested from a scientific point of view about why some couples are successful and satisfied and some struggle and end their relationships. They really wanted to look at what is the difference between those two groups. Or those three, really. There's the ones who are satisfied, the ones who are together but not satisfied, and the ones who are no longer together. So you really look in three groups. What are the essential differences? And in a nutshell, what they found was that the satisfied couples are better friends, and they do things to preserve and enhance that friendship. And friendship is, as psychologists would say, operationally defined. We define friendship in certain ways. How much do they know about each other? And are they keeping abreast of each other's changing world? How much do they like and admire and respect each other? And how good are they at expressing that to one another? And how do they connect in just day-to-day time? How do they initiate conversations and respond to conversations? And we call them bids for connection, where one just asks a question or maybe nonverbally reaches out and touches the other one and so on. So those three things, what do we know about each other? How much do we like and admire one another? And how do we interact in positive ways with one another? That defines a strong friendship. When couples are doing that, lots of things go well. They can repair mistakes or missteps or miscommunications more easily. They are more able to see their partner through a positive lens and give them the benefit of the doubt. And they're also more likely to have satisfying romantic and sexual experiences with one another. So looking at friendship, what are the friends like? Then years later, it was actually Julie Gottman's wisdom that came in and said, okay, we know that satisfied, successful couples have this good, strong friendship. How do we help couples who are struggling to move in that direction? And that was kind of the beginning of the Gottman Institute therapy side, creating interventions, creating a training program for therapists to be able to help couples focus on those issues of enhancing friendship. Of course, that's only one part of what the science was, is that satisfied couples are good friends. The second part, and this was really different than what a lot of psychologists thought at the time, satisfied, successful couples are very gentle when they bring up and deal with differences or conflicts. They're not just blasting out and venting and getting all the negative feelings out like you see in the movies. That's not the way they do it. People who do that generally hurt the relationship. What Gottman found out way back in his laboratory is that the successful couples brought up conflicts in a gentle way, they stayed in positive territory 80% of the time when they were talking about conflicts. So even when they're talking about, hey, how should we spend the weekend, or how should we get past this pandemic? And they have a difference of opinion. The way they talk about it keeps them in emotionally positive territory at least 80% of the time. That's sort of the measure. When it starts slipping below that, the conflict gets more and more difficult. So adding positivity to the conflict, how can I say things like, you know, I hear what you're saying, and it really makes sense to me. I get it, but you know, I see it a little differently. I want you to hear this part. Mm. You know, so they talk like that instead of, look, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't do that harsh negative stuff, at least not very much. And we also then learned that there are negative things that couples do, especially when they're having conflict, that really need to be eliminated. That they are just so negative, they really break down sort of the fibers of connection in the relationship. John Gottman labeled those the four horsemen of the apocalypse, pulling right. that image
right.
from the New Testament. You know, that these are the things that appear right before the end of the world. Well, these are things that appear in relationships that are collapsing. Hmm. And so part of the therapy is to help couples to identify those, to change them, to use a different way of talking to their partner that eliminates or certainly reduces their need or desire to be critical or defensive or contemptuous with each other. Hmm. And another thing the science taught us that was really, I think, special was the role of physiology. When people are upset, our bodies change. And when people are unhappy, when people are happy, you can see that in their bodies as well. So all of the science that was done and is still done at the Gottman Institute has that component. We're also looking below the surface, measuring things like heart rate, respirations, galvanic skin response, you know, how electricity moves through our skin, especially right. our hands. Measuring these physiological changes because when people are constantly escalating outside of normal, outside of the safe zone, that is a huge predictor of the trajectory of the relationship. Hmm. When people are getting upset, their hearts are racing, their mouths are getting dry, their blood is pounding in their ears. Well, if they don't learn how to control those moments, odds are the relationship's going to suffer. So we focus on that as well.
And to return to something you said earlier, which is this idea of friendship, that does touch me. And I mean, in the sense that we think of oftentimes a lover as a lover and a friend as a friend, but how to maintain the essence of friendship in a committed relationship, I think, is something that's so important on what you're hitting on. I wonder if you could offer us some tips when it comes to that, or ways that we can cultivate some of it.
Sure. There are some things that we've discovered that the satisfied couples do to enhance friendship and closeness, and then some things that we have suggested people try to do that. One of the things that couples kind of discovered on their own is that if they spend 20 to 30 minutes at the end of a workday, just debriefing the day, not talking about anything inside the relationship, but the outside stuff, what it was like on the commute, what happened at the office. That 20 to 30 minute conversation has been proven over and over again. If it's done well, You don't problem solve. You listen. You don't side with other people and say, well, maybe your boss had a point. You know, you stay on your partner's side and really spend that 20 to 30 minute end of the day ritual of connection, we like to call it, a stress-reducing conversation. That's one of the things that we didn't even think of. The couples thought of it. We saw it and said, yes, let's go with that. Let's teach it. But there are other things that enhance friendship. One of the things that we've done in therapy and in our workshops to help people with that is provide them with, like we've got one, it's a deck of cards actually, and you can also get it on an app that we call open-ended questions. A research study out of UCLA a couple years ago really shows that couples, they were looking at couples raising kids with both parents working. Mm-hmm. That was their population. And that those couples hardly ever talk to each other. And when they do, it's almost always about logistics. Who's taking the kids where, who's doing what? Well, that is a real slowing down of connection and friendship. Yeah, you get the job done, but your partner becomes more of a work partner rather than a friend partner.
Right, right.
So we have this card deck that we like to use called open-ended questions, and I just have people read through them and pick some to ask your partner and ask follow-up questions. Turn that one question into a 10, 15-minute conversation. And do that every so often, maybe every week on a date night or whatever, to get back into the habit of exploring your partner's world, exploring your partner's mind and their heart.
That's so great.
And we have other things like that to actually help people do stuff differently. We try not just to talk about, well, you need to do this differently. We try to actually give them some opportunities to do it differently and see how it feels.
Yeah. You mentioned kids as a major stressor, and boy, did my heart go out to those parents over the last 2 years that had kids. They were at home with them throughout the past couple of years and how difficult that was. But I wonder what the research shows us about other major stressors. We hear of things like money, for example. It could be in-laws. What are other things that come up when we think about the things that really tax a marriage or committed relationship?
You know, one of the things we learned is that all couples have perpetual differences, things that are based in their own background, their personality, their values, the way they view the world, you know, and they're never really going to change. Those differences tend to be permanent. They are either managed well, so that we can talk about them, stay in dialogue and compromise, or they're not managed well and they become gridlocks, which are arguments and shutting down and become very negative. So we really look for those areas where perpetual differences have become gridlocks. But you're kind of asking, what are the issues that we see that cause that are perpetual issues for lots of couples and become gridlocks a lot of times. And you name some of them. How to parent. You know, one person is really has a belief in just kind of let the kids grow and sort of like planting a seed in a garden and they'll just kind of grow on their own. The other one is much more, no, we need to be active. We need to teach. We need to train. We need to discipline. You know, use of punishment. So, yeah, differences on how to parent is one. How to be a couple while we are raising kids is another one. One person says, no, we really need to be there pretty much 100% of the time at the beck and call of the children. And the other person might say, no, we need time for us. We need to have babysitters. We need to put a lock on the door. You know, we need to train the kids to leave us alone sometimes, you know, so they have a difference about time as a couple versus time with the children. That can be a difference. And that will sometimes gridlock. The use of money is one. A big one that I've been dealing with a lot lately, it seems like, and it may be due to the pandemic, or it just may be some of the cultures that some of my clients have come from, but is the relationship with in-laws. How do you relate to my family? How do I relate to your family? How do we merge the generation above us, really, becomes a huge struggle for many. Relating to in-laws is one. Time apart versus time together is one that we see a lot of. You know, one person really likes to spend all their time, you know, they want to go shopping together, they want to go do activities together, where the other one really likes to go play tennis by themselves or golf or, you know, spend time alone, running by themselves and so on. So those, you know, differences in time together versus independent.
Yeah.
Differences in alcohol use.
Hmm.
Is a big one, you know, where some people say, yeah, it's fun, you know, or the other one says, no, it's really dangerous. We do too much. So I see that one. And it's not that we're not even talking about an addiction problem necessarily, but more just one person likes the party.
Yeah.
And the other one really gets disturbed by that.
Hmm.
So, yeah, those are some of the big ones, that I see, raising kids, dealing with in-laws, dealing with money, dealing with other things like alcohol, dealing with free time.
Yeah, that's an interesting list. A lot of that makes sense. And it's funny, you know, one thing that I hear from couples is that they feel sometimes that their partners feel that, you know, their friends are treated better than they are. Being kind and helpful, you know, we forget to do that when we're in a relationship, and it's so easy to take the other person for granted, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. I have seen that many times where I remember a friend telling her husband one time, will you please talk to me like I was one of your friends?
Mm.
And, you know, that was kind of a sad thing to hear. And unfortunately, they ended up divorced a couple of years later. And so, yes, that idea that I need to give gentleness, thoughtfulness, and care about how I say things. Part of that goes way back to that idea that I talked about earlier about love mapping.
Mm.
For example, there are certain words that I would never use with my wife because I'm not crazy. And I don't want the consequences of using one of those words. And there's about two of them. Hmm. And I know what they are, and I'm not going to repeat them here. But if I were to, in anger or even in jest, throw one of those words at her, it would hurt her and enrage her. So I don't do that. I try to be thoughtful. Just like I would with a friend. I wouldn't use, you know, negative language with a friend. One of the things that really hurts people sometimes is this idea of, I'm just joking. I'm just being playful.
Yeah.
Well, that may be what you think you're doing, but your partner's not experiencing it as play. Your partner's experiencing it as contempt, as being put down, which is the number one predictor of divorce or relationship demise. Hmm. Is when we feel like our partner's treating us with contempt.
Hmm. Well, Don, I've enjoyed this. I've learned a lot along the way, and I wonder, as we kind of wrap this conversation up, if there's anything that you'd like to leave us with in your years of working with couples, or any last kind of wisdom on this subject would be helpful as we start to say goodbye.
Yeah, there is. There really is, because we didn't quite get to this. if you don't do anything else, this is kind of speaking to the couples directly, get together this evening, maybe after dinner, and look at your partner and say something like, please tell me your dreams. Tell me what really matters to you. What is it you're trying to find in life? Tell me your dreams. And sit back and listen and take that in. That's something that we lose along the way very often, is that we got together here to fulfill dreams and to share dreams. And maybe we're not doing that anymore. And, you know, kind of make the opportunity to have that conversation. That can really change things.
Well, Don Cole is clinical director at the Gottman Institute and works with couples in multiple states and has hundreds of hours, if not thousands, doing this. And I really appreciate the thoughts you brought to the program today, Don. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for today. The producer of Life Examined is Andrea Brody. You can listen to this and all other episodes on your favorite podcasting app. And if you like what you hear, we'd love to read your review. You can also find us at kcrw.org/lifeexamined. I'm Jonathan Bastian. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.